Coming to you on some serious tape delay via a podcast near you. From that hockey hotbed of San Jose, California, it's Dudes on Hockey.
He is now accepting callers, he is calling me Dude!
And now, your hosts, Mike and Doug.
Welcome to Dudes on Hockey. I'm Mike. That's Doug.
What's wrong, dude? You sound a little upset.
You think?
I'm sitting here as Mike is getting ready for the podcast, and he has a nice glass of scotch. I, unfortunately, am on a drink limit because at any moment my phone could vibrate and I could be whisking my wife off to the hospital, but I'm going to watch dude drink this scotch and savor the inebriation for all Sharks fans as the Sharks go out in five, dude. And should we really be that surprised looking back on it?
I guess not.
We try to put sugar in the water, I suppose, and believe in those last four games when the Sharks rallied and made the push to even make the playoffs. And then I think somehow we convinced ourselves that St. Louis was the better draw of the two, which clearly it appears we're wrong.
Right.
And then they win game one, which makes you think that maybe this is going to be okay.
Could happen.
And they drop four in a row, dude. Four games in a row. Not really deserving to win any of those games. And tonight, going out in classic Sharks fashion,
right,
leading up until 10 minutes left in the game.
I think it was 8 minutes, 9 minutes,
makes
roughly.
It even worse. And then, on a really bad Mike Greer-style off-angle shot,
right,
Niemi lets one in.
Right. A shot near the post. Niemi somehow blocks it and blocks it towards the center of the ice for Jamie Langenbrenner to knock it in, tying the game. The Sharks reeling at that point. The Blues then quickly capitalize again, only 45 seconds later to take the lead. Blues go into full-on Blues shutdown mode that we've seen, about 95% of this series, and it's successful. And the Sharks go out basically with a whimper. I don't know how that could have been more disappointing. I mean, basically, they just choked it up. I mean, that song was called Song for the Dead, by the way, for those keeping keeping score at home. If you're not a Queens of the Stone Age fan, you should be. But not exactly the way that you would want the Sharks to go out. Basically, sort of a mirror image of game one. Sharks lead. Sharks give up the lead. The difference is the Sharks actually came back in game one and managed to score in overtime. And improbably. And yet in game five, the Sharks don't do the improbable and just cough up the lead and die like dogs. Not a good feeling. Not a good feeling. Yeah, there's a lot of theories I have about how the Blues played. I'm not sure it's even worth it to explain what those theories are now, because it doesn't even matter. Does it even matter now?
Well, I think it does matter because, you know, we'll make a lot of rash judgments, I'm sure, in the next 30 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Say a lot of things that maybe we'll change our mind about in the next few weeks as, you know, we've been flooded with tweets and texts from friends and listeners. Blow it up, you know, stab Demers, you know,
right.
Bring back Andre Nazarov.
I think I will read from the check that you wrote me for the playoff tickets that you wrote after the game was over. And you clearly weren't feeling great about writing me a check for the playoff tickets. And in the memo section,
yes,
of the written check, it says, I hate Colin White. So I appreciate that. I'm sure Bank of America appreciates that. and we can continue. I think that sums it up pretty well.
Dude, this entire playoff set, and I don't even think you could put the Sharks series in this category, because to people around the league, and I think to some degree we know ourselves, this wasn't that surprising.
It really wasn't.
The Sharks couldn't beat the Blues all year, and then, you know, they play them. I mean, it's so embarrassing. You play them 9 times, you beat them once.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
That's humiliating. Like, that's awful.
Yeah. Right.
You think about it that way, I mean, you may as well just be Columbus.
You know? Who can only beat another team one time out of 9? 11% of the time you can win the game.
Yeah. Well, the Sharks, right. It appears, with St. Louis.
That appears to be so.
You know, I guess there couldn't have been a worse draw in retrospect. And the Sharks, as we said when the game ended, they got what they deserved this year. They were hot and cold all year and were embarrassing on the penalty kill for the majority of the season. They made some desperation moves at the trade deadline that you could justify in the moment. But in the end, all the buttons appear to have been pushed wrong, and the Sharks are out with their quickest exit in Sharks franchise history. Is that right, dude?
That's what Fear the Fin tweeted. They said the Sharks have never lost in the first round in 5 games. So this is the quickest playoff exit ever.
It's amazing when you think back to those teams, the Sharks teams, the 8 seeds that made it. And then are we sure about that? Really, if you go all the way back,
hey, Matt D'Agostini, that's not my stat.
I guess I'm thinking back to the first time the Sharks made the playoffs, they won that series, yeah, right?
They beat Detroit in 7.
So I guess I'm thinking about they won that, and then they would go to the second round, and that's where they got murdered.
Or they lost in 6 to the Ducks the year they won the President's Trophy.
So just going off of raw emotion right now, dude, would you say in the last, 6 years, is this the most disappointing season or moment or end of a season to you? Or is still that Ducks loss, that 6-game first round series to the Ducks, is that more disappointing? Or is it more disappointing to lose and get to the Western Conference Finals? Where do you rank all this right now as a fan?
It's really hard. I'm having a lot of difficulty rating where this lives, because there's a different... It seems like there's a different feeling this time, and there's going to be a slightly different feeling every time, right? The thing about the Ducks is it sort of seemed like we ran into a hot team. The Sharks were good. They were the number one seed. They ran into a hot team. They didn't play well. They didn't match up well against the Ducks, and they lost, but they still had a good team. And now this year, with the Sharks going out against the Blues and Detroit going out against the Preds, we now see a team that was modeled after Detroit and Detroit themselves, sort of like the teacher and the student both bowing out. This seems to be sort of a out with the old, in with the new postseason, where you see young upstart teams that haven't had a lot of playoff success before, like the Blues and the Predators and the Kings.
And Ottawa. Ottawa leading that series against the Rangers.
Ottawa shocking. Winning tonight.
Even the Flyers, to some, although that series still has a ways to go, the Flyers are definitely a younger upstart team.
Right. At least against the Sharks losing to the Ducks, you could almost fool yourself into thinking that the Sharks could come back the next year and be a force in the NHL. And actually, it was borne out because they made it to the Western Conference, right?
Absolutely.
It's a lot harder for me to convince myself that now. Mm-hmm. When you think about LA next year and the Blues next year and the Predators next year, you think, how can this team have any playoff success as currently constituted? And so from my perspective, this almost feels like an end of an era. I mean, of course, we can talk about all the changes. And I know somebody tweeted at us about how, the coaches and the coaches' wives aren't going to want to hear tonight's podcast, which is probably true. I'm sure we'll get to them later. But there was a certain sense of finality in the loss tonight that I don't remember feeling in any of the other losses. It was just sort of like, we met a tough team against Chicago. We met a tough team against Vancouver, but the Sharks are still good. I'm not so sure the Sharks are that good anymore, and that obviously is scary. That's a tough spot to be in as a fan. You're like, okay, I don't know how good I'm going to feel come September. You know, am I really going to be excited about this team, or am I just going to be waiting for Joe Thornton's contract to expire so we can reboot?
Yeah, dude, I don't think you could have said it any better. I mean, I think that, especially seeing the teams around the NHL that are on their way out. I mean, you can include Chicago in that category too.
Yeah.
I mean, Chicago having a hard time dealing with a Phoenix team that plays exactly like St. Louis, and you're seeing those teams, LA, St. Louis, Phoenix, and Nashville, are going to be most likely the four teams they're going to advance.
All defensive teams. All good goaltending.
And the teams that they played, the offensive teams,
right,
are all out, most likely. Now, I mean, there's still some games to be played, obviously, in some of those series, but I think we can assume that's possible. And how shocking is that? I mean, it's surprising. And you look at, exactly like you said, dude, the teacher and the student, both near the end of the ropes. I think Detroit and San Jose both are in a lot of trouble if they don't adjust their philosophy on how to play the game in the way the NHL is being played right now, because they're clearly behind the times, right? I mean, it's not working anymore.
Well, I mean, you look at the Philly and Pittsburgh series, and that's like sort of the opposite of the Blues and Sharks series.
Sure.
And if Pittsburgh manages to come all the way back from a 3-0 deficit and win in that round, I think the vast majority of NHL pundits, including myself, will pick Pittsburgh to win the whole thing. So it's not that offense is dead. It's just that it seems like the jelly shoes and the short skirts of the 80s are being now replaced by the grunge plaid shirts and long hair of the 90s.
Dude, I like that. Nice.
So, so the Sharks are wearing jelly shoes is what I'm saying. That's basically what
I'm
saying.
The Sharks are in jellies?
Yes.
That's embarrassing.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's really, I mean, actually, you know, you think right now about, like, if you were a Detroit fan, like, we don't have Wings fan of Sharksland Chris here with us, although we threatened to bring him in, even though...
Maybe next week.
Maybe next week.
Maybe it's good to have him on next week, too.
But to be honest, like, it might be worse to be a Detroit fan right now, because, I mean, they seem to be at the end of the road, and they don't have a Logan Couture and a Brent Burns.
Right, yeah.
Like, they have...
They really are losing. I mean, yeah. You know, if you're Lidstrom, I think...
Lidstrom and Holmstrom are both probably going to be gone.
Probably going to say enough, you know?
Right.
I think you've got to figure his body's had enough, especially when he figures they're not going to win. You know, right. I mean? That's done. You know?
So let's pick over the bones a little bit here.
Okay.
So what did the Sharks do? Or, I mean, obviously they didn't score. Okay. So that's obvious.
Yeah.
Obviously the PK was terrible. That's obvious.
Right.
So is there a theme here? Is there some way to tie this all up in a bow to say this is why the Sharks basically suck and the Blues, who didn't have a single player to score more than 25 goals, managed to beat the Sharks, not only beat them, but beat them handily and actually embarrass them almost every game. Like, there were embarrassing, dominating performances by the Blues in every single game. How do you explain that?
Taking the gift that's given you, opening it and playing with it. You know, I mean, that they, whenever the Blues had an opportunity, they made the most of it. And the Sharks, I mean, you saw tonight, you know, Pavelski on the doorstep, right in the chest, you know, in the glove of Elliott. You know, they were shooting Hanzus right in the chest. You know, they had opportunities. Couture's breakaway in game four, he scores that goal. That whole game could have shifted. It could have shifted. And the momentum might have been on the Sharks' side, and they could have built on it. But the Sharks just were unable to take advantage of any of those opportunities. And I don't know. I kind of put half the blame on the players. I put half the blame on the coaching staff.
Yeah.
I think they are equally to blame for this,
mm-hmm,
because they didn't adjust at all. And the adjustments they did make, including playing Michael Hanzus twice after he basically was sent to Leprosy Island, and then you recall him and throw him out there, and he didn't do anything.
Right. He had a couple decent plays tonight, but
the energy, I'm sorry, but the energy of Gagliardi and Moore was missing. And then you're going to bring in Brad Winchester and play him for 30 seconds. You know, what's the point of that? Like, that was so predictable that was what was going to happen.
Right.
You know, we've seen it from them before. He has no trust in that type of player. So why even have him sitting on the bench when you're not going to play him? I don't have the stats, dude, D'Agostini, but I bet Winchester played under 5 minutes in game four.
Mm-hmm. Likely. You got the iPad right there. You can pull it up.
I guess so.
Maybe I'll launch into my theory of the series.
Okay.
Because it may be too long-winded, but who cares? See, I got alcohol in front of me and it's over. My working theory that I've developed over the last two or three games is that the Blues dared the Sharks to beat them one-on-one, and about 100 times a game, the Sharks declined that challenge. And you can say in retrospect that the Blues had better players to a man than the Sharks. That's still a tough sell. Like, you're telling, I mean, probably the best player, the best NHL player in the series was Joe Thornton. Certainly the best Sharks player who played in the series. But like, if you were drafting and you had all the Blues players and all the Sharks players in a pile, you would probably draft Joe Thornton first, right? So the Sharks probably had some of the best players in the series, and the Blues dared the Sharks to beat them. And the Sharks declined. They played aggressive hockey. They put in two forecheckers every time. And what would the Sharks do? The Sharks would rim it around. The Sharks would dump it up the middle. And the Blues, who were checking everyone really closely, working hard, they said, okay, Martin Havlat, beat me 1-on-1. And you know what? He did a few times. You know what? And Daniel Winnick did a couple of times. And Joe Thornton did a couple of times. But not nearly enough. They didn't try enough. And so the Blues were left saying, okay, we're going to play, frankly, a more risky system. Because if you have a breakdown in that system, if you have a couple guys out of five or one or two guys out of five who say, okay, I'm going to play a little softer, then the whole system breaks down. What you had is you had a whole team buy into this system, right? And that's what everybody's been talking about all year with this whole Ken Hitchcock business, is that you have a whole team buy-in. And it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. Everybody plays with this chip on their shoulder. David Backes is going to go in and dare Scott and dare Joe Thornton to beat him 1-on-1. Scott Nickel is going to go in there and dare Joe Thornton to beat him 1-on-1. And you know what? Or dare Patrick Marleau to beat him 1-on-1. And you know what Patrick Marleau said? No thanks. I'm going to pass it again behind the net and see if some great passing lane opens up. And you know what? It didn't. It never did.
So, dude, do you put that squarely on the players? Or I think they've been told that's what they're supposed to do. That's how they were coached to play this. That's how they've been coached to play for 4 years. And it did work. I mean, we saw it work to perfection, you know, in the first 3 years. We saw how far they went. And it did not work. And their refusal to back off that style was the death of them. And I guess you're going to go down on your own sword, I guess.
I suppose.
But the thing that frustrated me also in that is, you know, you saw in game three when the Sharks were down 3-0 and just completely dead. And then in the last, I don't know, 6 minutes, Colin White scores that garbage goal. And then the Sharks start forechecking two guys. And then they score a second goal, right? Oh, no, I'm sorry. And then Jumbo took one, right?
Right.
And then the penalty kill was so aggressive, the Blues had no idea what to do. Like, they were completely frozen. And then the Sharks score again, and you're in there like 20 seconds left or whatever.
Right.
And you just know they're not going to come all the way back. But you look at those last 6 minutes and how aggressive they were, and you go, you know what? If they had played the way the Blues played, they might have won this game in five. Because they have the better players.
Right.
They do.
Right.
They have the better players. It was the style that they played that was so easy for Hitchcock to drum up a scheme to beat. It worked 8 out of 9 times.
I agree.
That's all the evidence you need.
I agree with you. And I agree with you that it was at least partially a failure in coaching, if not mostly a failure in coaching, because the Sharks, despite a vast and growing mountain of evidence saying that this doesn't work, they still played like that in game number 5 when they were down 3-1 and they're sitting there playing the same way again. It's just, it's so frustrating. I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think that the coaching staff will probably be let go That's my initial reaction. Especially you talk about the penalty kill, which was really just a wretched penalty kill. They play so passive, and the point of playing passive is that you keep the play to the outside and you don't let passes go through the center of the ice. The Sharks played passive and they let passes go through the center of the ice.
So you're basically doing nothing.
You're basically doing nothing at all. You give extremely skilled NHL caliber players time and space in the center of the ice to handle the puck and try to score. Guess what happens? They score. I don't care if you're the Blues with a 23 goal score as your number one score, or if you're the Penguins who have a 100 point score as their number one score. They will score, and they will score again and again. And we saw it this series. I lost count how many passes got through the four-man box on the PK. I mean, it's so embarrassing. And so maybe even for that reason alone, you might see the coaching staff let go, because that is purely a coaching decision. The players decide not to go out and challenge the points. They don't challenge down low. And the coach says, good job. That's exactly how we want you to play. Now, clearly, Ken Hitchcock said something different.
Would it stun you to know the Sharks don't have the worst PK in the playoffs?
It would. Who does? I mean, I know that they're
the
firing.
The Penguins have a 45% kill.
Right.
And the Devils are tied, which Devils, ironically, were the best PK team in the regular season.
Uh-huh.
Their PK is 62% right now. The Flyers' PK is also 66%.
Well, the Flyers, I mean, the Flyers have been basically scoring at will, except for games, you know, 4 and 5.
This is, it's hard to imagine right now in this moment how the Sharks can move forward and be successful with Todd McClellan and the entire staff as the coach, just based on how married he is to that philosophy. And that's his style. That's what he knows. That's what he's seen be successful. He has a Stanley Cup ring to prove it. And it is being successful in the Eastern Conference. I mean, mm-hmm. Ottawa is winning this way.
Right.
You know, yeah. Ottawa with Paul McClain, they're playing this way. They're beating the Rangers, you know. Can't convince me that they have a better roster than the Sharks.
Right.
But it's working.
But the Rangers don't play like the Blues do. That's the difference.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, they play similar, but not as aggressive,
not
right?
Not quite.
Yeah.
Not nearly, actually.
So, dude, I think, you know, first gut reaction is, yeah, McClellan and company, you can't start to make this thing right.
Right.
Unless they're gone. And that doesn't mean that he didn't have a good run as the coach of the Sharks.
And it doesn't mean that, it doesn't even really mean that he's not a good coach. It just means he doesn't appear to be any longer the correct coach for the Sharks.
Right. And we saw Ron Wilson 4 years in San Jose had some degree of success, less success than Tom McClellan did.
Mm-hmm.
But after 4 years, Doug Wilson said it's time for the classroom to have a new teacher. And I expect to hear that same quote again in the next few weeks, you know, and maybe it won't be until after the finals are done. I don't know, but I'll be disappointed if it doesn't happen.
I'll be disappointed if it doesn't happen as well. And I'll be shocked if it happens before the finals are done, because that's not Doug Wilson's style. And I know I've talked about it several times before when people have called for coaching changes. And my philosophy still is, even the fact that I don't agree that Tom McClellan is the right coach for this team anymore, you don't find a new coach. You don't fire the old coach until you have a new coach in mind. You don't just sit there.
Right.
You do that due diligence. And of course, you know, you be respectful to Tom McClellan. It's not like you're interviewing new coaches while Tom McClellan is still ostensibly the guy behind the bench. But you've got to have a plan, an idea of, okay, who's out there? Who do we want to interview? What kind of style are we looking for? All those kinds of things. You don't make those kinds of changes and just flail around.
So let me throw out something a little crazy. All right.
Might
Since
as well.
We're talking about crazy.
I'm going to take a sip.
There's another team that's been pretty disappointing in this playoffs, and it was a guy who reportedly was offered the Sharks coaching position and turned it down. Do you think it's possible Joel Quenneville is going to be canned in Chicago? And is it possible, you know, that's the kind of guy that you turn to here? Would you be interested if he got fired?
I would be interested, but I would be surprised if he was let go. That's my initial reaction to that statement.
Why? How is that different than what's going on here?
Because they still have a young and good team. the core of their team is still young and good.
And you haven't got it done for 2 years in a row.
And you can make the case that the core of the Sharks team is no longer young, right? I mean, clearly, if you turn it over and you go to the young crowd, that means you go with Burns and you go with Pavelski and you go with Couture. And that means Marleau and Thornton and Boyle, to our dismay, are on the outside looking in.
Don't say it, dude. Don't.
I don't want to say it. But you look at the Chicago Blackhawks, that's a different story entirely. The core of their team are all like 27 and under with Kane and Taves and Keith.
Yeah.
And if you think that none of those guys are the right core for that team, then you're screwed anyhow. It doesn't matter who your coach is.
I'm not saying they should fire him. I'm just saying, just listening to the Puck Daddy podcast, the topic came up, you know, and actually they talked to the Chicago beat writer about it, and she was pretty insistent that she thought Q was safe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you lose in five to Phoenix in the first round, two early exits from Chicago 2 years in a row with that young core talent.
Yeah.
You know,
you're
it's possible that, you know, he'll be on some shaky ground. I don't know. We're going to have to do our research. And then, of course, also there's no lock that's even going to happen. I mean, that I would say, dude, it's possible that Doug Wilson might not do anything, right? I mean, he might just walk forward and say, I still believe in this coaching staff. I still believe in this team.
I think that's very possible. I think it's very possible. Yeah. And the one team we look to as a template, I think right now, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, is that we look to the Philadelphia Flyers as a template as what to do next year. What did the Philadelphia Flyers do last year? They traded their two best players. They went younger. They kept some good young players like Claude Giroux, and they made another run at it. And if you take into account how we have seen Doug Wilson describe that he does not rebuild, he does not trade all the good players and go for draft picks and do the Edmonton Oilers wrap and get the number one pick 3 years running. He will reload and not rebuild. So when you think of what Doug Wilson might look to do, he might want to trade Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau and go for the Braden Schenn guy, go for the Wayne Simmonds and try to reload. That might be something that I could get on board about. The thing that would be a little bit depressing is to see the exact same personnel next year, because it seems like we now have almost irrefutable evidence that the current personnel is not going to get it done.
No, that would be beyond depressing. If they just rolled that same team out there with maybe, you know, a minor change, oh, we're going to bring in Brendan Morrison.
Commodore.
And Mike Commodore's coming in, and goodbye Colin White. And you
right.
know, that's just sad. You know, that means your eyes aren't open. I think Doug Wilson's eyes are wide open. And I think, as we've seen, you know, he's not afraid to make bold moves. But the problem is, dude, is, you know, your two players that I think you're looking at and going, if you're identifying the team, the face of failure, it's Patrick Marleau is the face of failure.
Has to be.
And he has 2 years left, $6.9 million a year, a no movement, no trade clause. And this guy has, you know, has firm roots in San Jose and the community. That's going to be a really difficult person
and
to trade.
Voted the fan favorite this year.
Right. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So,
and Mark Purdy wrote an article, and we might have to have Mark Purdy on in the next couple of weeks, but Mark Purdy wrote an article about how, I mean, he put it perfectly, which is basically the seemingly lack of emotion from Patrick Marleau does not work in his favor. It might actually help him on the ice in some ways, right? You don't have two high highs or two low lows, but it looks like to the outside observer that he has no heart. Mm-hmm. And certainly his output in this playoffs... Dude, appears to be that he has no
heart. It doesn't look like that to the outside observer. It looks like that to a guy who was in the locker room with him for 2 years, Jeremy Roenick.
Yeah.
He clearly has a major problem with Patrick Marleau.
Yeah.
And wasn't afraid to tell millions of people about it. Well, maybe not millions. I guess that many people don't watch playoff hockey, right?
People but are clicking on and off of Mike Milbury appears.
He wasn't afraid to mention it. So I don't think it's just us on TV. It's people in that locker room think he doesn't have any heart, obviously.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is the guy that, you know, if he comes skating out of that shark's head again, you're just like, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed.
Right. Same.
It's the same.
Same
it's,
shit, different day.
It's hard to say that things are going to change or get better. And the other player in that equation that it would hurt a lot is Joe Thornton. You cannot blame him for what happened this year or in the playoffs. He busted his ass.
He did.
Tonight and every game this series, he busted his ass. And you said it at the beginning, he was the best player on the Sharks team and probably the best player on either team. I mean, maybe you get an argument for people about Brian Elliott.
Andy McDonald.
Okay, well, Andy McDonald all of a sudden is Wayne Gretzky. I mean, that's the thing. You know,
but all of his points were on the power play, by the way. But no, 6 of his 7 points were on the power play.
No game plan. That guy's a midget. He should have been slaughtered. You should have had Brent Burns go, you know, should have Tonya Harding him.
Yeah.
You know, he never should have been. He was always in and around the net. How is that tiny man allowed to skate like a pest, like a mosquito, you know, sucking the blood out of Niemi's playoff dreams and hopes and sparkles and glitter?
That's poetry.
Dude, thank you. It's upsetting. You know, Andy McDonald, I mean, that's a joke.
I mean, this
guy, it's not like you got beat by Malkin or like you got beat by Patrick Kane. You got beat by Andy McDonald. I mean, this guy was good 5 years ago.
He was like the fourth best player on the Blues.
No, he was a good player 5 years ago on the Ducks. Not good now. Like, come on.
You draft the players on the Blues, he's like sixth or seventh. He's behind Oshie and Perron and Backes and Elliott and Halak.
That's what makes
this. And probably Pietrangelo.
Even.
He's sixth, seventh maybe.
I'm f***ing mad, dude.
Yeah, Chris Russell. I think I'd rather have Chris Russell than Andy McDonald.
I'm mad. All right, well.
I'm mad too. This is bull. I'm tired of this shit.
Uh-oh.
I'm so tired of it. It's so annoying, right? I mean, here comes the salt, right? I mean, we talked about it for 30 minutes, and now the real emotions come out.
We've tried to kind of toe the line and be a little bit unemotional, but...
And have some perspective and all that. Whatever.
If you're going to play like a bunch of then you're going to lose.
You're going to lose.
And that's what happened, dude.
I know. I know. So
all
frustrating.
Right. Okay, sorry.
Okay, let's... Why don't we get off this a little bit and talk about some of the other series? Because there's been so many surprises, still ongoing surprises. Florida's up. The Sens are up. I picked the Wings to win. They're already out. I mean, LA's up. I mean, what crazy topsy-turvy world are we living in here? What's going on? Okay, let's start with the craziest series, the most entertaining series. Is Philly going to win? Or is Pittsburgh going to come all the way back and win 4 straight games and take the series?
I would say at this point, yes. I mean, that's what I expect to happen because everything's just so crazy. I mean, it's upside down bizarro world. I expect Rick Santorum to be come back in the race and be elected at this point.
With dude. Rick Perry as the ringman. Could happen.
Oh my gosh, dude. Yeah, I mean, if I was in Vegas, I'd bet on Pittsburgh. I would, you know, I mean,
game 7 in Pittsburgh, that's sort of the thing, right?
You can, it's going to happen, you know, and you know, you have a friend who's a Flyers fan and he's in full-on panic mode. Freaking out.
He was in full-on panic mode after they lost one game.
He should be. I think he should be, you know, the Rangers Ottawa series. I don't understand that at all. Like, I mean, I don't understand that at all. I Ottawa is young and fun. I appreciate that. But if the Rangers lose to Ottawa, I don't know. Maybe John Tortorella is going to be available.
That's a way bigger upset. Yeah, that's like the biggest upset in a long time.
You know, after all the money they spent on Brad Richards, if they lose that series, I can't believe that they'll lose that series. You think they're going to lose that series?
Well, again, they have Game 7 at home. That might be their saving grace.
I
if they
guess.
Have Game 7 in the Garden, they could probably win if they can get past Game 6.
The New Jersey Florida series, you know, is just so bizarre. Florida,
like you said, New Jersey has like the worst penalty kill all of a sudden. It's not like they're the Sharks who've been terrible all year. All of a sudden, they just suck. They're just terrible. What is going on?
Yeah, that's bizarre. And, you know, the defending champion Boston Bruins, perhaps being on their way out.
My number one overall pool pick. The Washington Capitals, I had written off months ago.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, Alex Ovechkin gets like benched in the third period and they end up winning. It is inexplicable.
Are we living in a world where the Florida Panthers could be the top seed left in the second round of the playoffs? That's what's going to happen.
Right. We're going to see a Florida Panthers-Phoenix Coyotes final or Florida-Nashville final.
Should we get the gun away from Gary Bettman?
Yeah, seriously. Gary Bettman is like...
What if Phoenix wins the cup and the NHL, like Gary Bettman's up there as the owner's all, yay!
That'd be so amazing.
Yay me!
It was my idea to trade for Antoine Vermette. Oh my God, can you imagine?
What do you make of the Kings Canucks now that the other Sedin is back?
Yeah.
Has Vancouver got a shot to do what Pittsburgh's doing?
They got a shot. I don't say they have as good of a shot because Pittsburgh's my favorite, but they have a shot. I mean, they've had offense all year. They have extremely dangerous offense. They have... Well, their goaltending seems to be a problem, which is clearly something LA doesn't have.
Schneider has not been bad in those two games. He's been pretty good.
He's been pretty good, but I take Quick every day of the week and twice on Sunday.
Right. Well, that's a bigger problem. I mean, you look at Vancouver, you want to talk about an off-season turmoil. I mean, there could be a lot of people with their head on the choppy block up there. The Hodgson trade looks awful right now. That looks terrible. Zach Cassian has done nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Zach D'Agostini. I'm not totally sure about that, but I'm pretty sure he's done almost nothing. Watch, he leads them in scoring, dude.
Yeah, but, Zach Cassian leads in scoring.
You know, that trade, Luongo, I mean, if they lose this series, how can they bring back Roberto Luongo,
he's
right?
Going to be gone.
He's got to be gone. I mean, it's a mess. I mean, some of the teams that are at the top of the Western Conference, the teams... that you see this turnover. I mean, I guess the Sharks have been at the top for so long and we've been part of that group. And now we're seeing the cool kids in the class are all turning into the fat nerds.
Right.
At the same time, we're all going to fail PE together.
And the young pimply face kids are all starting to smoke and wear leather jackets.
If I have to climb the rope again, I swear to God, dude. Do you remember doing that? Your junior high, the rope climb?
Made me tingly.
The sit and reach?
Oh my God.
You're going to do the sit and reach or the squat. The Phoenix Chicago series is, I don't see Chicago coming back in that. The Rafi Torres suspension, dude, we should talk about that.
Let's talk about that because we don't have a lot of time left. But
25 games for Torres. Right decision?
No. I'm going to say no.
No? Too little?
That hit wasn't that bad. I mean, the problem is the same thing I've said many times on the podcast for people that have listened to us for a while, is that, and I think Jonathan Toews said almost exactly what I've been saying at some point, and he said, we have no idea what to expect in terms of discipline from the NHL. That is a huge problem. You have players who don't know what's going to happen when they do certain things on the ice. That is a massive issue for the league. And so now, Rafi Torres hits a guy from the front, he doesn't hit him in the back end of the boards. Hits him from the front. Okay, he leaves his feet. I'll give you that. He happens to contact Marian Hossa's chin. The fact that Marian Hossa is a superstar clearly factored in. The fact that Rafi Torres is a third or fourth line player clearly factored in. To me, those things are basically irrelevant. I understand you want to factor in the fact that he's been suspended before. I get that. To me, you give him 8 games, 10 games maybe. There've been the James Neal hit was worse. There's been Malkin elbows. There's been a Brent Burns elbow, as much as we wouldn't like to admit it. There's been some pretty cheap shots out there in the playoffs, and nothing. The Shea Weber thing is worse to me. That's worse. That's a deliberate intent to injure by Shea Weber. So this only reinforces what I've been saying all along. Players have no frigging clue what's going to happen when they hit guys.
Yeah.
Okay, Marian Hossa gets knocked out. You can say after the fact that, yeah, okay, he's going to get suspended. A different time, a different place, a different angle. You just hit Marian Hossa solid and he goes down. You see guys leave their feet all the time. None of those guys get penalized. It's only based on results and based on who the two players are, where they live in the depth chart. And to me, this doesn't help anything. I mean, Brendan Shanahan wants to put the hammer down. Great. Okay. A little late.
I think some of the things you're saying have merit, dude, but I think you're mostly wrong. All right? This is the Scotch talking. This was an awful, violent hit by Rafi Torres. Hossa didn't have the puck anymore. you know, in Shanahan's, you know, dissertation on the hit that he gave, I mean, you can see that Torres attempts to play the puck and then hits Osa. That's terrible. I mean, you knew he didn't have it. All you're trying to do is take him out. He left his feet and leaped like Superman into his head. And, you know, if it's a one-time thing, then maybe you're right. The 5 to 8 games might be the right decision. But the fact that Shanahan could show evidence of 5 or 6 other suspensions that he's had for the same thing,
right?
You've got to come down on this guy or he's going to kill somebody. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And I believe that Torres is remorseful. I read what he said today. I don't think he's trying to hurt somebody, but it sounds like he needs to go and take the happy pills and see the therapist that Matt Cook saw.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Or his career in the NHL could be over. I mean, you're seeing even a guy like Jordan Tootoo, who doesn't play quite like that, but similar in Nashville, he's not even playing.
Right. I mean,
they're not even playing him. You know, hey, if he played for Todd McClellan, he definitely wouldn't play.
Right.
Wakata-ta, yakata-ta, wakata-kata. All right. Brad Winchester. So... I think he got what he deserved, dude. That's fair. But on the other hand, the Shea Weber intentionally shoving someone's head into the pane of glass and getting nothing, that's embarrassing.
Right.
Like that's clear favoritism. I agree, dude.
Right.
It does have to do with the person who did it and the person who got hit. So there is that.
Right.
How do you know?
How do I
know that he really loves me?
I can certainly appreciate that point of view that, you know, Torres has a history of this and 25 games is legitimate. I could be convinced of that. What I can't be convinced of is the fact that this sends a completely mixed message by the NHL, and this is going to do nothing to solve the problem that people have been talking about all year, which is that too many people are getting hit in the head, too many people are getting knocked out of the games with concussions, and the fact is the players still don't know what's going to happen. The players still don't know what's going to happen, which means this is going to continue. This will continue until there is an across-the-board strategy to punish these kinds of hits, regardless of the outcome. Because Rafi Torres can't predict with any accuracy what the result of that hit on Marian Hossa is going to be. He's just trying to hit him. Okay, he hit him too high, but you know what? If Hossa gets up and skates away, Rafi Torres is probably playing the next game.
You're right.
So that's what I'm saying. Players have to be able to predict before they make the hit what could possibly happen.
How can you do that, though? I mean, the speed that this game is played at, you know, either you have to eliminate hits to the head altogether, which is, I think, what they're trying to do. Don't hit people in the head. If you get hit in the head, you're going to be suspended for a long time. But then on the other side, when you grab someone's head and smash it into the glass and nothing happens,
right,
then you're right. It's a mixed message. How do you know?
Well, players can predict the same way that they can predict if they take a two-handed shot and they hit someone in the side of the head the way Marty McSorley did. Guess what's going to happen? You're going to get suspended for a year. How many people get two-handed in the head from behind right now? Nobody. You know why? Because they know what's going to happen. Okay? If you do the same thing and you go in real tall and you leap into the guy's face as a hit, players don't know what's going to happen right now. If you say every time you do that, I don't care what happens as a result of the hit, you're getting 6 games. I don't care if the guy's hurt. I don't care if it's a penalty. I don't care if it's from the front. I don't care if it's from the back. If you hit the guy in the head with your shoulder, you're getting 6 games. Guess what happens? Nobody makes that hit anymore. The same way no one takes a two-handed chop to the side of a guy's head right now. It's the same deal. It's the same thing. And I think the league is basically unwilling to do it because the Don Cherries and a lot of other people will say, oh, you're taking all the hits out of the game. You're taking hitting out of the game. This is obviously a longer discussion, and we're getting kind of out of hand now, but... I mean, that, you know, it's a sickness in the NHL. And unfortunately, I think Brendan Shanahan has proven himself, at least so far, I hope he can right the ship. But at least in his first year of tenure as whatever his VP of player safety, whatever his crazy title is, he's proven himself not up to the job. Mm. It's unfortunate because I like Brendan Shanahan. I liked him as a player. I liked that hire. I thought his, for instance, the suspension of James Wisniewski early in the year was the right call. And he has lost his nerve. It's too bad. It's too bad. But I'm glad we're talking about this because then we're not talking about the Sharks.
Oh, dude, I'm going to bring it right back to Teal. Dude, before we close up shop, because I know we're approaching that magic minute mark here where you start to get irritable around the 45-minute mark.
Right.
If anyone's still listening and If you're listening, you know, you're
if anybody's been listening, they know I've been irritable the whole time.
Most disappointing player in the series.
It's got to be Patrick Marleau. Did he have any points? I don't think he had a point.
I think he had one, dude.
One point.
I think he had one, but I'm not positive.
Patrick Marleau, you know, the cliche is your best players have to be the best players. He was supposed to be the best player, tied for, or him, you know, only a goal or two behind the scoring lead, around 30 goals for Patrick Marleau, and he doesn't even have a point in five games, or 1 point in five games. Yeah, the blame's got to fall on him. He has more responsibility than Colin White does, or Douglas Murray does. So he has a lot of responsibility. Dude.
Oh, dude, this just suddenly got way, way better.
My wife is bringing in cocktails. Lord knows we need them.
Nicole, say something to the listeners about the season and your reaction to the playoffs.
I'm really sad the Sharks lost, but they deserved it, sort of. So they kind of sucked. So, and screw that other team.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Well put. Well put. You just said, we could have just done the podcast in 30 seconds to let you.
We've been talking for 46 minutes, and Nicole
basically just said the same thing.
She says the entire thing in 30 seconds that we just said in 45 minutes.
I'm going to go Joe Pavelski, dude.
Yeah?
I'm going to say Joe Pavelski with no points. No points in the first four games. I don't think he got a point on that Joe Thornton goal tonight. Joe Pavelski. I mean, Mr. Yeah. Clutch.
Yep.
Nothing. And he got worked in the faceoff circle in this series. I think Patrick Marleau, who did also have no points unless he got a point on that goal tonight. Those two guys...
Where's Ryan Clough at?
Ryan Clough had three assists in this series.
Okay.
You know, pretty invisible assists.
Yeah.
But they have to share the blame. And I think Joe Pavelski gets a little bit of a pass maybe because he's been so good mm-hmm. in other situations. But because Patrick Marleau is now the poster child for the Sharks' doom and gloom, you know, he's going to have to bear the brunt of this. One last question before we cheers to the end of this season. Is Antti Niemi the goalie for this team to be successful going forward? How much blame do you give him, dude?
Well, certainly the tying goal tonight was not good. Okay. Okay. So that I'm going to answer a question with a question.
Yeah.
The question is, do elite teams have to have elite goaltenders in this new style of NHL play?
Yes.
Because if the answer is yes, then Antti Niemi is not the goaltender.
They do. I mean, you look at the teams that are left in the Western Conference. Mike Smith is having an otherworldly type season for his career. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Pekka Rinne is a Vezina Trophy candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Quick. Who's Jamie Quick? Oh, he played for the Kansas City Royals. Jonathan Quick is a Vezina candidate, right? And Brian Elliott and Yaroslav Halak were the best regular season tandem
ever,
right? Yeah, ever. So, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Then no.
And the team that won last year had Tim Thomas.
Right.
So, in this new era, so that's a problem. I mean, the Sharks have some major problems that will break down over the next several months as we're waiting for the season to commence, dude. Sharks hockey may be done, but we're not done.
We're not done, dude. We may be Sharks fans. We may be very disappointed in the way the season turned out, but cheers.
Cheers to you, dude. No matter what happens, I'm not going to throw out my jersey.
Me either.
I still bleed teal. I know many of you do too. And we'll keep talking about it as long as they keep playing. And that's another issue, I suppose, is, you know, we're headed towards some labor discussions. So
yeah.
Will there be a next season, I guess, is that other topic.
Probably. But I implore the people who listen to this podcast and bleed teal the way that we do, I implore you, don't stop watching hockey. It's so painful that the Sharks are out. We couldn't be more disappointed. This is one of the most dispiriting losses we've ever seen as fans of the Sharks. There's a lot of good hockey left in this season, even though the Sharks aren't going to be a part of it. Watch these series. Watch Pittsburgh and Philly. Watch Chicago and Phoenix. Watch these games. Watch the Cup Finals and the Western Conference Finals. Watch as much hockey as you can, because frankly, you know, the 3 or 4 months in the summer where we have no hockey to watch, I'm a mess. I hate it. It's terrible. So keep watching hockey. We'll be back again next week, hopefully slightly more sober.
Well, I'm completely sober, dude, but I'm very proud of you for having multiple cocktails. And, dude, it's possible the next time we record, it could be dad. I mean,
dude,
this is...
that's trippy.
This is pretty trippy, dude. Yeah. So,
Easton Sky Santana could be a part of the podcast.
No name officially announced yet, right. But when the baby arrives, we'll post her in her Sharks gear on the blog, awesome. I suppose. So I guess we'll say for right now that we don't know when our next episode will be because of the unknown certainty of whenever my daughter's going to decide to exit the chamber, as I call it. So I guess if I'm sitting here next week with you, that means that we're a little delayed.
Yeah. We'll podcast when we can, dude.
We will. We'll be back at some point.
But we'll be back soon.
Dude, thanks for another great season, and I love you, man.
Love you, too.
Think the show sucks? Want to get your questions on the air? Email questions at dudesonhockey.com. Dudes on Hockey is not affiliated with the San Jose Sharks organization or the National Hockey League.